Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and we have, again, our monthly veterinary voice with Dr. Marty Greer. And I'm really excited. I was just telling Marty, I'm very excited about this topic because I think it's something you guys are going to love. And it's something I love. And it's something that Marty is very passionate about. So this is a great topic. And we're going to talk about managing neonates, right? Like baby puppies and things that can go wrong and things that we can do to make sure they survive and all of that. Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah, I think this is a great topic.
Awesome. And you sent me the most amazing piece of information. We're going to have this up on the website, but I just want to go through some of these things and talk about them more, about how you assess the condition of your bitty baby puppies.
That sounds great.
Awesome. So APGAR, it's a great acronym, you know?
Yeah, it is. And so there's a little bit of trivia here. APGAR is a score that was developed in the 1950s for use in human babies. It's been adapted for use in dogs and cats and other species as well. So the original APGAR stands for appearance, is the A, P is the pulse, G is the grimace, A is activity, and R is respiration. Now, dogs and cats don't grimace the way babies do, so right. We have to do some modification of how this is all laid out. But do you know where the term APGAR came from? This is trivia that you probably don't know.
No.
It was developed by an anesthesiologist in the 1950s. So those of us who were born in the 50s and since have all been APGAR scored, named Virginia APGAR. So Virginia APGAR, the doctor, took her last name and turned it into this acronym, which I think is pretty brilliant.
I love that.
Yeah, who knew who Virginia APGAR is anymore? But in the 1950s, for her to be an anesthesiologist,
right,
was a pretty remarkable thing in the 1950s. There were very few female doctors
of any
especially
kind.
In anesthesia.
Yeah. Wow.
Exactly. So this is a really valuable tool that has been used on millions and millions and millions of people, literally, as a way to assess their risks at the time of birth. So the APGAR scores go from 0, 1, and 2. So 0, 1, 2 for an A, 0, 1, 2 for P, 0, 1, 3 for G, 0, 1, 3 for A, and 0, 1, 2 for respirations. So you can get a score of anywhere between a 0 and a 10, depending on the viability of the newborn.
Okay.
So it really helps us to classify what risks we're dealing with. If you have a puppy that comes out screaming, it's a 10, and it's going to have a much better likelihood of outcome than the puppy that comes out limp, blue,
right,
non-responsive, not breathing, maybe has a pulse but isn't breathing. So those are going to make a big difference. So we know from the data, and all this data that I'm going to share today is developed from a group called NeoCare in the south of France, in Toulouse, France, at the veterinary school there. So they looked at a number of litters of puppies and determined some risk factors and then classified them according to what kind of risks these puppies were at based on their scores. So a problem APGAR score is anything less than a 7. And according to their data, it shows that those puppies born with a less than 7 APGAR score have a 22-fold greater risk of death in the first 8 hours after birth, but that puppies between a 4 and a 7 can achieve up to a 90% survival rate if there is appropriate intervention. So those are going to mean repeated or continued resuscitation efforts, including suctioning, oxygen supplementation, if necessary, epinephrine. In our practice, we use caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
If we have slow respirations or no respirations, ventilation may include something as far up as intubation of the puppy, and then the veterinary care based on what they need. And puppies of a 0 to 3 really, really need intensive resuscitation efforts if we're going to get them to survive. So you can't just set them off to the side at your C-section or at the time of birth and say, oh, well, you know, you'll be okay, because they're not going to be, they're going to need a lot of intervention.
Right. Can I interject something right here? Because I think this is really fascinating. Growing up with Clumber Spaniels and a lot of other, you know, we had problems with getting these puppies going, whether they were C-sectioned or live. We were early on taught to swing the puppy to clear the lungs. And I have been in conversation with my vet, with my most recent C-section, actually. And she is now talking and sharing information that the swinging that we are also familiar with is not recommended. Can you speak to that just a tiny little bit?
I would love to speak to this. Yes, it is no longer recommended, and it hasn't been for a long time. Unfortunately, there are still veterinarians and breeders out there who still think that swinging or slinging, depending on which technique you decide to use, is an appropriate approach to managing the airway, and it really is not. There's two techniques that we use in our practice regularly, and then a third one if necessary. The first is the bulb syringe, which everyone is familiar with, that little blue sucker thing that you use on the noses of little babies. It can go very nicely into the back of the throat of a puppy, and it does a good job getting rid of the thick mucus that can accumulate in the back of the throat and interfere with the puppy's beginning respiratory effort. The second is to use a Deele mucus trap, and it's spelled D-E-E-L-E-E. It's not just a thing that I made up. It's actually called a Deele, and I'm sure it's named after somebody too, but I don't know.
You don't have the trivia on that one.
No, I don't have that one. But you can purchase them for under $10. They're reusable, of course, on the veterinary side, but on the human side, they would only use them for one baby, and then they would throw it away. But it does a nice job of getting rid of the thin, watery fluid that accumulates. And some of our staff members will get as much as 3 to 5 cc's of fluid out of these puppies' airways when they're trying to get them initiated breathing. They tend to have more at C-section than they do at vaginal birth, because the vaginal birth does have a bit of a squeeze that goes with it we don't get with a C-section birth. But those are the two pieces of equipment that my staff regularly use, and they alternate back and forth between the two until they get the puppy started to breathe. Now, if in the efforts to do that you still don't get the puppy breathing, then there's some other techniques we use, up to including intubation. And if you have the puppies born at a veterinary clinic by C-section, and your veterinary technicians are willing to learn how to do an intubation, it can be really easily learned by some practice. So if you lose a puppy, sadly, don't let it go to waste. Ask your veterinary technicians if they will practice learning how to put an endotracheal tube into that newborn. It can be done, and vet techs will do anything for a dozen chocolate chip cookies. So if you just bake them some cookies and take them in, they will practice and they will learn to do it, and you will save puppies with a bit of information and that skill set.
Can you give us the change in thinking, the decision-making that said, okay, swinging these puppies is bad for them because, and help people understand that piece too?
Sure. We call that shaken baby syndrome. And what it does is it increases the intracranial pressure inside the baby's skull. So as you're swinging that puppy downward, you're creating a coup-contra-coup lesion, which is that brain damage that happens in shaken baby. So we've actually had puppies that have, at postmortem, if they haven't started breathing and they die at birth, you can open up their skull and you can actually see that bleeding inside the brain. So we do not recommend that any longer. And I've actually had one technician many, many, many years ago that had a puppy slide out of the towel and across the floor. So it can be really dangerous.
To be honest, that has happened to me.
On a lot of levels.
I will tell you that happened to me personally. So,
Yeah. And they're slippery when they're born. Yeah, you do want to be really quite careful with it. Now, the other things we'll do along with the Deele mucus trap, the bulb syringe, if we can't get them breathing prior to intubation, we will use the GV26 acupuncture point with a 25-gauge needle that you can do in the upper lip of the puppy. That's a respiratory stimulation center for acupuncture. So using a 25-gauge needle in the upper lip can be helpful. If after 10 minutes we don't have breathing, there are people who will use Dopram. It's a highly controversial topic, I will tell you, that there are a lot of anesthesiologists that won't touch it. The problem with Dopram is, although it is a respiratory stimulant, the risk to it is that if you're trying to stimulate respirations at the same time that there's not any oxygen going to the brain, you can actually increase the amount of oxygen needs in the brain without oxygen getting there. So people think that it can cause brain damage. I will tell you, I know there are dogs walking around out there today that wouldn't be here if it weren't for Dopram. So I don't use it until 10 minutes have elapsed after birth. I use it very conservatively, but when push comes to shove, if everything else has failed, then I'd rather use Dopram and take a chance on it with a puppy that I don't think is going to make it than to just stand there and shrug my shoulders and say, gosh, I don't think there's anything more we can do. And then we do dissolve caffeine tablets like the no-dose tablets in water, and I'll put a drop of that on the tongue of a puppy as well. And caffeine is used on the human side for babies with sudden infant death syndrome. So we do know it's a respiratory stimulant in that fashion as well. So there's additional techniques, but I don't think anybody should whelp a litter at home or at the veterinary clinic without a Deele mucus trap. Like I said, they're under $10, and I will tell you that you will definitively save puppies very effectively with a Deele, and it's the greatest tool that we've ever had for fetal resuscitation.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Thank you so much. That piece right there is invaluable, in my opinion. So thank you.
Good.
Okay, so that's how we're managing these puppies that are having low Apgar scores, right?
Correct. And that's regardless of the size of the puppy. So the other things we're going to talk about are going to relate to size and viability in other ways.
Okay. Weight.
Right. We'll talk about weight, litter size, which does have a relationship with weight, and then the 3H syndrome, which is hypothermia, hypoglycemia, and humidity hydration. So those are the other 5 points of what we're going to go over so that we cover everything completely.
Excellent.
So we know from the NeoCare study that low birth weight puppies have an 81% greater chance of death in the first 48 hours, and puppies in the lowest 25% of their breed have an increased risk of mortality as well. And then a lot of people will say, well, you know, weight loss happens in puppies, and up to 10% is probably okay, and actually it's not. We don't want our puppies to lose more than 4% of their body weight in the first 24 hours because that is associated with an 8-fold increased risk of death. Now, we know large breed puppies have large puppies and small breed puppies have small puppies, thank goodness.
Yeah.
So toy breed puppies are typically born at around 100 to 200 grams. Giant breeds may be up to 800 grams. I've seen puppies as heavy as 2.5 pounds, so it can be quite a large puppy. But we know that a small puppy has an increased risk of death. And of course, then litter size will also have that relationship because larger litters tend to have more puppies total, but their birth weight per individual puppy will be lower. So those increased size of litters will have an increased risk of death. Now, you can't control litter size and you can't control birth weight, but you can control the amount of nutritional support. And if you need to give colostrum or plasma, you can control that. So those are the two pieces that you can really manage from a weight and litter size perspective is make sure everybody gets the chance to nurse. You may have to rotate puppies. You may have to tube feed puppies or supplement them in some other way. There's a couple of nice nursing bottles on the market. There's a lot of good nursing formulas that are out there. I don't like to use cow's milk unless it's the middle of the night and it's just to get you through until you can get to the store or your Amazon delivery comes with your nutritional supplements that you should be feeding. And there are some really nice nutritional formulas on the market. We try to avoid goat's milk because that does lead to some nutritional cataracts and some other deficiencies. So I try to stick to the formulas that are actually made to feed newborn puppies and not use some of the other substitutions.
Interesting. Okay, so that is a piece right there, the goat's milk, that is a new piece of information to me. And I know in previous litters, I have used the goat's milk Esbelac, that sort of a thing.
Right.
Is that something that you would recommend or stay away from?
Yeah, I like the goat's milk Esbelac. I like the Foster Care by Revival. So there's a couple of really good products on the market. But like I said, you try to avoid the just plain
raw
cow's milk or the homemade formulas because those are going to be deficient in some amino acids that are required for the development of the eyes. And you'll end up with nutritional cataracts if you're not adequately supplementing the puppies with the right formula. A good ophthalmologist at a surf exam or an OFA exam can usually tell the difference between a cataract that's caused by a nutritional deficiency when the puppies are very small compared to a genetic or inborn type of cataract. But I try not to take any chances on that. And when a good product is on the market, I think we should be using the product that works the best. Now, I like goat's milk from the perspective that the puppies gain weight well and they have very little diarrhea, but it is not nutritionally complete. And the other formulas do a very good job of replacing the goat's milk. So goat's milk or cow's milk in the middle of the night is okay till morning. But as soon as the sun comes up and the store is open, you need to get out and get something if you don't already have something at home in preparation for the whelping.
Excellent. Excellent. Very, very good information. Thank you. I mean, this is all, I've been doing this a long time and several of these are points I'm like, okay, good. Good to know. Well, you know, we all learn every day, right? Isn't that the whole point of this exercise that we're doing?
I hope so. If we're not, we're doing something wrong.
Absolutely. And I love this podcast for that opportunity. Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
Welcome back to Pure Dog Talk. This is Laura Reeves, your host. We are live in New York City at the Big Apple Westminster Kennel Club. And we have been visiting with Trupanion customers all week and telling some amazing stories. And I have here Crystal Schuyler. And she's going to tell us a story about how Trupanion helped her Lagotto Romagnolo. Tell me all about it.
So we had someone who had our dog as a foster, and they were just throwing the ball in the park, and the dog slid down the hill and kind of went into a tree. And the back legs went one way and the front legs went the other way, and the dog herniated its back.
Oh my God.
And so when the dog went, you know.
Down.
Down
like dead,
yes. And so we rushed it to the vet there. And sure enough, you know, the insurance paid for everything.
And they pay directly to the veterinarian.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Like, it's nothing out of your
pocket. Yeah, it was like a $10,000 surgery.
Right.
And then we had the aftercare, so we were taking care of the dog.
Right.
And they did all of the treadmills.
Right, all the the physical therapy.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just...
acupuncture, laser therapy.
And they covered all of it.
All of it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I think we paid maybe $2,000 out of it.
Of a humongous bill. That is insanity.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Crystal, and I'm glad your dog is back. And it's good now, yeah?
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
Okay, so one of the things that I'd love to spend a little extra time on is this 3H you're talking about. Hypothermia is so important, hydration is so important, but the humidity piece is another new one to me. So let's kind of dig into that a little bit.
Sure. Well, hypothermia is a body temperature below 94 degrees. So puppies need to be kept so that they're body temperature with a rectal thermometer is 96 and above when you're trying to get them to nurse.
Mm-hmm.
If puppies nurse or you feed them, tube feed them, bottle feed them, when they're too cold, then the formula or the milk gets down into the intestines, the intestinal tract stops moving, which is called ileus, and then the puppies will tend to have regurgitation of that fluid and then the risk of aspiration. So aspiration is rule number one that we want to avoid with hypothermia. Hypothermia also will then contribute to dehydration because they're not adequately taking in fluids and it's not adequately being absorbed. And then, of course, the next step would be hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. So those things all go together along with the humidity. Humidity is really important that we have it at 55% plus or minus 10%. So I recommend that people have a weather station, which is one of those digital thermometers with a humidity gauge on it. You can buy those under $10
right.
on Amazon, on eBay, you know, there's the local hardware store. They all carry these. And I really think that when you're looking at the value of litters, that if you don't have a $10 weather station and a $10 Diva mucus trap, you're really not giving your puppies every opportunity that you can for survival. So we're really careful with humidity.
And so the humidity is helping keep them hydrated?
In turn, yes, it does help to keep them hydrated and it helps to keep them warmer as well.
Okay.
So if it's too dry, then they're going to chill as well. So, you know, it always feels hotter when the humidity is high. Florida doesn't feel like Arizona at 90 degrees.
Right.
So that's the same principle.
I love this. Okay, this is wonderful. So if you see a puppy that, you know, you pick up the skin, it's tenting a little bit, it's telling you it's dehydrated. What are our go-tos on that?
Well, it's a little hard to assess hydration on the skin turgor test alone. That's where you lift up the skin on the back of the neck and it tents. Because puppies don't have the same percentage of body fat that adults do. So the way we assess hydration in our practice is by urine color. So I take a dry cotton ball or a dry Kleenex and stimulate the puppy to urinate by rubbing on either the vulva area or the penis area.
Mm-hmm.
And if the urine comes out with a dark yellow color to it, the puppy's dehydrated. And regardless of whether the puppy's gaining weight or not, I think you need to increase the humidity and you need to increase the amount of fluid that the puppy is taking in. So if that means letting the puppy nurse more, if that means giving mom some medication like Reglan and oxytocin to improve her lactation, if that means giving the puppy a tube feeding, if that means giving the puppy sub-Q fluids, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ways that we can adequately rehydrate these puppies. And typically, once they're rehydrated, they take off and they start to do better. But all of those things are factors in how we manage the puppy's environment and how we support the puppies with intervention, with tube feeding. Please don't sponge feed. That's a whole nother topic. Tube feeding, supplement feeding, you know, whatever technique you want to use, plus increasing the humidity. There's a lot of different things that we can do. And sub-Q fluids can be a real godsend to puppies that aren't strong and doing particularly well.
Yes, I've saved several that way.
Yeah. And my very favorite fluid to give, if the puppy was colostrum deprived in any way, either because mom didn't have enough colostrum or the litter was too big, so, you know, puppy number 12 was born after all the colostrum was sucked down by the first 11, mom's sick, mom's not lactating well, puppy isn't nursing well, then I use a lot of plasma in our practice, which is the frozen fluid part of the blood that can be a substitution for colostrum because it does contain antibodies and some other magical, mystical things in there that we probably don't even understand to give the puppies an immune system start and to give them some proteins and some other, like I said, magic fairy dust that we don't even understand is there.
Right. And I'm just looking at your paper here. You can actually give the plasma sub-Q.
You can. In the first 6 to 12 hours, I like to give it with a feeding tube orally. After that period of time, the intestinal tract no longer allows those large protein molecules to be absorbed through the gut. So then you can give it subcutaneously, you can give it intravenously. It can be given intraosseously, which is, of course, going to happen at your veterinary clinic.
Right.
But any of those techniques will work. I still will give it a little bit later than 12 hours if I have a puppy with really severe diarrhea. For treating bad diarrhea, then I'll give it orally for the local effect of immunity that was shown in dairy cattle.
Here's another one that I want you to speak on, because I have just recently kind of gone this direction, but I haven't seen this research about this. You're saying avoid using a heat lamp specifically. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I have personal experience with starting a fire in my barn. I have a client that had personal experience starting a fire in his garage using a heat lamp. So I am personally not a fan of heat lamps. Number one, of the fire risk. Number two, the risk of dehydration. And number three, the bitch, the mom, is just really uncomfortable under the heat lamp. It's just too warm for her. She tends to not want to spend the amount of time that really is required for her to be with the puppies if you're using something that's keeping that surface too hot. So I heat from underneath. I have, for the last 30 years that I've been breeding, used the T.E. Scott whelping nests. You can still purchase them. They don't come with a box. You have to build the box that goes with it. But they're a heat source from underneath, and it works really extremely well. It's round. It looks like a wok. It's black. It's got texture to the metal. And the puppies will just naturally migrate to that surface. The bitch can lay just next to it, so she's comfortable. The puppies can crawl off of the surface over to mom, nurse, and then slide back onto the whelping nest to stay warm.
Right.
And I've had very, very good success with that product over the years. I finally wore out my first, and I still have the second one that I bought. So they do last for an extremely long time, and you can build them into any custom size box that you prefer based on the size of your bitch. They do come in two sizes. And then you build the box and the size of the box and whether you put pig rails or not and the height of the walls and all those things can be varied based on whether you have a Clumber Spaniel, a Corgi, or a Greyhound, because that's, of course, going to be all different parameters for that.
Right. Well, and I think, I can't remember, it was honestly because of this podcast, I don't remember which one of the podcasts off the top of my head. I think it might have been Avidog, might have been that one. But talking to somebody and making sure that the room temperature isn't so high, but the, as you say, the underneath temperature is warmer and a place for mom to be that isn't so hot and that type of thing, I thought was really good.
Yeah, those are my preferences.
Nice. Okay. And then hypoglycemia. I mean, talk about your personal experience. I had a little puppy, a litter I was bottle feeding, and she had a hypoglycemic seizure, actually. It was very strange, and I nearly wound up losing her, finally got her back. But this, I think, is an important topic also.
Right, and it's most commonly the small breed, the toy breed puppies that we tend to have hypoglycemia with. But any small puppy that's not adequately nursing can have that happen. And there's so many people out there now that have their own glucometers that they can use at home for themselves if they're diabetic or a family member is diabetic. You can use the same device, or you can purchase one called a PET test. It's a PET test glucometer along with the sticks, and they're very affordable. They're about $35 to $40. So I think it's a really good idea if you've got, especially toy breed puppies, or if you're struggling with raising your puppies. It's simple to do, just a stick on the bottom of the puppy's foot, collect enough blood, which is just a drop, to put onto the stick into the glucometer and get an idea of how high or low the glucose is. We want it to be above 90.
Okay.
We know that if it's less than 90, that they have a fourfold increased risk of death.
Mm. Okay. See, I really, really love all of this because it's just some of it is stuff I've learned in the School of Hard Knocks. So having actual data is like so amazing.
Right. And I can show a video of a litter of puppies to the old ladies that breed poodles in Milwaukee. And from a video, they can pick out which one is the sick puppy.
Oh, yeah.
But not everybody has that skill set. Not everybody has 40 years of breeding experience.
Right.
So if I have a newbie or if I have somebody that's really struggling and they're not having the success that we think they should be having raising puppies, I now have some information, some data, some things that you can actually measure. So when they call or they come in, we can say weight gain, weight loss, what was their original weight, what was their glucose, how hydrated are they, what are their temperatures. These are the only things that we can measure. So yes, we can do blood work and we can do other things that are more complex at the veterinary clinic. But at home, these are things that you need to be able to do and to measure and to evaluate so that you have a good handle on what's going on and that you have a high puppy survival rate. The literature reports up to 40% of newborn puppies are lost, and that's just a tragic loss, especially when the puppies have a lot of value, both emotionally and financially. It's not just about the money. It's about how your heart breaks when you lose somebody, and it's about how hard it is on your bitch when they lose a puppy. So there's a lot of factors that come into play here.
Would you do this bit on tube feeding, the five P's of safely tube feeding? tube feeding, I'm going to be honest, I have never actually been able to bring myself to do it. And it's probably because I'm just nervous and neurotic. So I would love it if you would be able to share some of this.
Sure. And there's probably some good videos out there on tube feeding, YouTube and so forth. But there's some little tips and tricks that I can give you that we can go over. So the first thing to realize is that you're going to have a greater loss of puppies by watching a puppy starve to death or not adequately stay hydrated and not being strong enough to nurse than you will by having an accident at tube feeding. Do those accidents happen? Yes. Do they happen often? No. And if you're really careful, they shouldn't happen. But every now and then you'll still have a puppy that'll aspirate. But the techniques and tips that I have are, I'll start with pee. Number one is, before you place the tube down the puppy, you want to pre-measure the tube so that you measure the tube from the tip of the nose to the end of the last rib. So you'll put a little mark, a piece of tape or a magic marker or something on the tube so that you know that the length is correct. Because if you're in that far, you're in the stomach, you're not in the trachea. Okay. Number two is, before you feed, you want to pinch the puppy's tail or toes so that you can hear the puppy vocalize. If the puppy makes a sound, then you know you're in the right spot, because you can't be in the airway if the puppy can cry. Three and four are passing with the chin down and passing with the tube off to the left side. And then the fifth, of course, is making sure the puppy and the formula are both warm. So you want the formula to be warm. On your wrist is fine. You don't have to use a thermometer if you're used to that. That's fine. And make sure the puppy's temperature is at least 96 degrees rectally prior to the time that you feed. So pre-measure the tube, pinch before you feed, pass with the chin down to the left, and pre-warm the puppy in the formula. Those are the five P's that are going to make tube feeding a manageable thing for you.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you so much, Marty. This is great stuff. This is literally life-saving great stuff, and I really appreciate your time on this.
Well, take a look. It'll be on the website. It'll be great information for people to reference back to.
Absolutely, and I plan on bookmarking this one. Thanks, Marty.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the Dog Show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.